Let me say how happy I am to see each of you here today, and I want to commend you for your willingness to engage in this vigil and stand in the midst of this rather inclement weather to express your support for all of those who have been arrested as a result of their courageous actions resisting the tragic, unfair, and unjust draft system of our nation. I've just had the opportunity of visiting my very dear friend, Joan Baez, her mother, and our dear friend, Ira Sandpearl. And they all send their greetings and their best wishes to you. And I might say they are in good spirits. You know, when you go to jail for a righteous cause, you can accept the inconveniences of jail with a kind of inner sense of calm and an inner sense of peace. And this is the way they are accepting that experience. Amen. They have supported us in a very real way in our struggle for civil rights, our struggle for freedom and human dignity all across the South. And I decided that in a way, or rather as an expression of my appreciation for what they are doing for the peace movement and for what they have done for the civil rights movement, I would take time out of my schedule to come out to see them, to visit them, and let them know that they have our absolute support. And I might say that I see these two struggles as one struggle. There can be... There can be no justice without peace, and there can be no peace without justice. People ask me from time to time, aren't you getting out of your field? Aren't you supposed to be working in civil rights? And they go on to say the two issues are not to be mixed. And my only answer is that I have been working too long and too hard now against segregated public accommodations to end up at this stage of my life segregating my moral concern. For I believe absolutely that justice is indivisible, and injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And I want to make it very clear that I'm going to continue with all of my might, with all of my energy, and with all of my action to oppose that abominable, evil, unjust war in Vietnam.
Rap on, brother.
Now let me say this. I see some very dangerous trends developing in our country. Trends of oppression and repression and suppression. And I see a definite move on the part of the government to go all out now to silence dissenters and to try to crush the draft resistance movement. Now, we cannot allow this to happen. And we've got to make it clear. We've got to make it clear that to indict a Dr. Spock, to indict Bill Coffin and the other courageous souls that have been indicted will mean indicting all of us if they think that this draft resistance movement is going to be stopped.
There you go. Talk a little while.
And let us continue to work passionately and unrelentingly to end this cruel and senseless war in Vietnam. I don't have to go through all of the things that this war is doing to corrode the values of our nation. Suffice it to say that the war in Vietnam has all but torn up the Geneva Accord. It has strengthened the military-industrial complex of our nation. It has exacerbated the tensions between continents and races. And the war in Vietnam has placed our country in the position of being against the self-determination of the Vietnamese people. And then it has played havoc with our domestic destinies. And I can never forget the fact that we spend about $500,000 to kill every enemy soldier in Vietnam, and we spend only about $53 a year for every individual who is categorized as poverty-stricken in our so-called war against poverty, which isn't even a good skirmish against poverty. And I say that that is a great need now for a radical reordering of priorities in America, and that is a great need for a revolution of values. And I say to you in conclusion, that we must continue to stand up and we must continue to follow the dictates of our conscience, even if that means breaking unjust laws. Henry David Thoreau said in his essay on civil disobedience that non-cooperation with evil is as much a moral obligation as is cooperation with good. And I do not plan to cooperate with evil at any point. Somebody said to me not too long ago, Dr. King, don't you think you're hurting your leadership by taking a stand against the war in Vietnam? Aren't people who once respected you gonna lose respect for you? And aren't you hurting the budget of your organization? And I had to look at that person and say, I'm sorry, sir, you don't know me. I'm not a consensus leader. And I do not determine what is right and wrong by looking at the budget of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference or by taking a Gallup poll of the majority opinion. Ultimately, a genuine leader is not a searcher for consensus, but he's a molder of consensus. And on some positions, cowardice asks the question, is it safe? Expediency asks the question, is it politic? Vanity asks the question, is it popular? But conscience asks the question, is it right? And there comes a time when one must take a position that is neither safe, nor politic, nor popular, but he must do it because conscience tells him it is right. And that is where I stand today, and that is where I hope you will continue to stand so that we can speed up the day when justice will roll down like waters all over the world, and righteousness like a mighty stream. And we will speed up the day when men will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks, and nations will not rise up against nations, neither will they study war anymore. And I close by saying, as we sing it in the old Negro spiritual, I ain't gonna study war no more.
Mr. King,
to find out something about his visit to Joe Myers.
We had a very, can you hear, goes through in the music? Uh-huh. We had a very fruitful visit with Ms. Baez. The visit was mainly to express our support to her for her courage, for her willingness to stand up and face suffering and sacrifice in order to make it clear that the position of our administration is totally wrong in Vietnam, and in order to make it clear that war should cease and people of goodwill must work to bring about an end to war everywhere.
Do you anticipate any attempt to get her out before her time is served?
No, they don't know about that. They are supposed to be getting out on the 2nd of February, I think they said, and they have no knowledge of any attempt to get her out any earlier than that.
Dr. King, could you explain what you're quoted as saying, that you're now for escalated nonviolence? What did you mean by that?
Well, I made it very clear that the anger of our ghettos is very extensive, the bitterness is very deep, and in order to give that understandable anger a kind of creative and constructive channel of expression, we've got to escalate nonviolence to the point that we make it much more militant, much more demanding, and much more insistent, even if it takes on the dimensions of civil disobedience. I feel that nonviolence must now be strong enough to be an alternative to riots on the one hand, but also an alternative to timid supplications for justice on the other.
Dr. King, will you clarify once and for all the reported statement that you have said that Adam Clayton Powell is the only man who can now save the nation?
Well, I tell you, there's so much confusion about what Mr. Powell said concerning my statements to him and my visit with him, that I would rather not make a comment until I've talked with him, because the press has reported certain things attributed to Mr. Powell that I never said to him. And I don't want to get in a public debate with him about what I said to him. I'd rather talk with him about that privately.
Well, in your version, what is your version of this conversation? Did you say anything like that to him?
I don't know anything about any statement like that made to Mr. Powell.
What did you say, sir?
Oh, we talked about many things. I was there to get a few days' rest and spent a good deal of my time in Bimini talking with Mr. Powell. I didn't go there for that specific purpose, but after getting there and running into him, I did talk with him a good deal. We talked about the movement. We talked about, and I mean the civil rights movement. We talked about his unjust dismissal from Congress, and I do think that was a grave injustice, not only a slap in the face of Mr. Powell, but to Negro people generally. But some of the other things that he stated, at least as I have seen them in the press, are things that I never said, and I don't want to say anything about it until I've talked with him, because he could have been misquoted.
Did you invite him to speak in Atlanta?
Yes, we did talk about that. When he told me he was coming to California, I mentioned to him that it would be a good thing for him to stop and preach in my pulpit in Atlanta, but we didn't get a chance to get back to that. So that it didn't work out.
Mr. King,
since that was the reason for coming to Bimini, that you had pressed nonviolence past the breaking point and you had alienated the masses, the black masses.
Well, there again, I wouldn't want to get into debate about this. I did not go to Bimini to confess any sins. I went to get some much-needed rest that the doctor demanded that I get, and I just ran into him in the process. I am more committed to nonviolence than I have ever been in my life, because I think it's the only answer to this very difficult problem. I have seen statements where Mr. Powell said I was ready to discard nonviolence, and I don't know where in the world he could have gotten that impression. As far as alienating the masses of Negro people, I think we would have to look at what is happening and face the fact that polls reveal, both the Harris poll and a recent poll by Fortune magazine, that from 88% to 90% of the Negro people of America feel that my approach to the problem is the best answer. Fortune just came out last week, where 88% of the people felt that my approach was the best approach in dealing with the problem, and 92 said they trusted my leadership more than anybody else. So I think that would be the answer, rather than saying that I've alienated the masses of people.
Dr. King.
I'm going right back to Atlanta, Georgia.
What are you planning on doing back there?
I'll be there in a two-day workshop with my staff and give them their marching orders, so to speak, to go into 15 communities where we will be mobilizing people by the thousands for a massive mobilization in Washington on the question of jobs and income, and we plan to begin in April. But we will be meeting for 2 days, tomorrow and Tuesday, going through our whole program and techniques of organization and action so that they can move into these communities and get to work.
Hey, Dr. King, we would like violence, sir, with hundreds of thousands of people involved.
Well, we're going to start out with a core group of 3,000, and we're going to spend at least 2 months carrying them through the discipline of nonviolence. We feel that if you can get the initial group committed to tactical nonviolence, at least, nonviolence can be as contagious as violence. The main thing is to get your core group committed, and this is why we're going to spend at least 2 months training them in the discipline of nonviolence.
How long will you stay in Washington, D.C., sir?
Well, we're going to stay until something is done about these conditions, these intolerable conditions. We're going to have certain specific demands, which we're working on now, and we're going to stay in Washington until we get an answer that we consider a meaningful, good faith, forthright answer to deal with these problems.
Do you think there'll be violence in Chicago this summer during the Democratic convention there?
I can't say. There are groups speaking of having demonstrations around the convention, which I think is a good idea, but I haven't had a chance to meet with any of the groups so far, and I would hope that the demonstrations will be large, numerically strong in order to be effective. But I would also hope that they would be nonviolent in character.